Hi, this is Kate Brownfield from ADHDKidsCanThrive.com. And today I have two special guests from the Off Point podcast in London and UK. And today I have Les with me and Marlon. And Les has ADHD. You're about 30 years old, right, Les?
I turn 33 tomorrow, actually.
Oh, 33. Happy birthday. Yeah,
thank you.
Okay. And he's an, anyway, I found Les because he's an advocate because he has ADHD, and he often writes about having ADHD to bring about awareness and help others who are going through the same thing. So that's how I found him. And then he has his best friend, Marlon, who's here with us as well. And we're going to talk a little bit with Marlon about what it's like to be a best friend with Les. I think that'll be fun. Okay, so Les, the way I found you is an article you wrote up in Attitude Magazine came up, and it said three things you need to do to get your morning started. So yeah. I clicked on that and I laughed because I have a young son, and I was like, I'm not sure all these strategies are going to work for us quite yet. But it was funny because you said, so the three, I can't even remember what the third strategy was, but it was have some coffee, have sex every morning. And what was the third thing?
I think I wrote about a month ago, actually, because there's a bit of a backlog in between when I write these things and then I get publishing. But I think it was, sex, coffee, and breakfast. Yeah, I mean, lately I've been just kind of...
like a high-protein breakfast. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But honestly, I mean, I'm single at the moment, so I think it's probably just... I mean, I think they made me look a little bit more lonely than I actually am. But and I was a little bit uncomfortable when I read through the edit, and it was like... because we don't really say the word intimacy as Brits. So it's a little bit like, it's like, and intimacy. And I was like, I'm not desperate. I'm just saying it's a good.
Yeah. No, I thought I appreciated your honesty and I thought it was good advice. And so here we are now talking to you about how it's been for you having ADHD and the parts of you that you want to bring into awareness that can help others. So you were diagnosed later in life, which I would say in your mid 20s, right? I'm curious, how did you make it to your late 20s? How did you go that long without a diagnosis?
Well, mostly because, I mean, you know, like, well, I think most of it is the fact that I kind of always knew that I was a bit odd, but there was a lot of misdiagnosis going on. Because with the NHS, we kind of knew that there was something up, but we could never really figure it out because, for example, as a child, I'd be quite a bit more emotional than my peers and I'd get bullied, even though there was no reason for me to get bullied. There would be quite a lot of emotional reactions. And for me, that's why I write about the most is the emotional side of things, because that kind of impacts me the most. Academically speaking, I never really had much trouble but I did struggle a little bit when I came back from Malaysia. So for about 2 years, I was in an international school where the education was insane. And so I came back and I knew all the answers. And, you know, being a kid with ADHD, you know, my hand would just go flying up without thinking. And there was none of that social awareness that it was annoying people or anything like that.
Where in your international school? No,
in the international school, I was perfectly accepted. It was one of the few times when I wasn't, you know, like sort of where I never felt socially out of place. But I think that because, you know, I mean, everyone was odd in their own way. We had Australians, we had like this massive melting pot of everything, and all the kids were bright. And if they weren't bright, then they would, you know, the education was second to none. It was the best I've ever received.
Oh, fantastic.
But it was expensive, and you know, my dad's an engineer, so his employers paid for it as part of the package. But you come back to a sort of state school where there is, I'd say, the education is less well funded, and the teachers do their best with what they've got, but there's a curriculum nationally that has to create a standard, and growing up that standard was nowhere near what it was in Alice Smith, which okay. his name is
Wim Kael. That's the way it is in the United States too. It's kind of very standardized, one size fits all, or that's the way it's supposed to go.
it was all right, but it's just that you know, there were little things that we noticed as I was kind of growing up. And at age 9, I was tested for ADHD by 2 people. The first one said I had it. Then my mum was a bit like, but they've been passed. You know, they would apparently. The feeling was that this particular psychiatrist was just kind of more about passing, you know, like getting people saying, yeah, you definitely got ADHD. Here's a bunch of drugs, rather than really doing an in-depth assessment. So because I kind of showed up with that, my mum was a bit like, she was hesitant because she was a teacher in the 70s and 80s. And she found there'd be a lot of kids like me who were just full of life, energy, you know, really lovely kids. And what would happen in the 80s would be that they would get diagnosed with ADHD. And then the next day they would come in on way too much Ritalin and drugs like that. And then they'd just be zombies. And my mum just looks at a kid and she's like, well, I don't want this wonderful child to be that way. So she was a bit hesitant. And we just kind of accepted that I was, because I did an IQ test as well, and I came up very, very high. I mean, I don't know how much this is my mum bragging, but about top 4% of the population.
Wow. Globally. Yeah. Okay.
So, and I'm not trying to show off in saying that, because believe me, I drank away at least 10 or 12 IQ points in my university day. But, you know, like there were several little hardships that came up. Like I used to have, you know, physically I had tonsillitis for about 7 years, and that kind of was exhausting. But I think the ADHD kind of paralleled it out. So I could still I kept acting like a normal person, but actually I was extremely fatigued. And
you were fatigued because of the tonsillitis?
Yeah.
Because it was hard to eat and stuff?
No, it's when your glands like swell up, and but it's just kind of a constant thing. So, you know, like it's a bit like ADHD actually. It's normal if you don't know it's wrong. I've got a friend who has had arthritis all her life, and she just thought that people's bones do normally ache, or their joints normally ache. And she just thought that's what everyone was like, because it's when I did get diagnosed and on the drugs almost immediately, the strangest question, the one that I always struggled with, like almost ethically, is the question they ask you is, do you feel better now? And it's a big question, because it implies that you were ill before when you weren't. My interpretation of ADHD is that we're just wired differently, and that's good. It's neither a good nor a bad thing. It's just kind of a difference in the way that, you know, Marlon's black and I'm white. It shouldn't make a difference. He's just as intelligent as me. You know, we're good friends. That's why. You know, not because he's black. Sorry, but you know what I mean. There are some things that are just,
yes,
know,
we're all different. Not bad. Yeah,
we're all wonderful little snowflakes.
We all have our differences.
But,
okay, so did you take, you started taking medicine as an adult?
Yeah, I mean, I had about 2 years of kind of figuring it out. I think it was on, I don't know if you want me to name brands, but I've kind
No, you don't need to. I was just curious if you eventually did find yourself wanting to take medication to help with focus?
Yes and no. I mean, I managed to get a master's degree in the meantime, and I'd say that in terms of my academic abilities, it's never a hindrance, because it means, you know, there's a lot of advantages to having it. But I'd say that in work, you know, more structured environments like corporate or high pressure environments, the problem is that the ADHD is triggered, and those symptoms of sort of missing details and things as triggered by stressful situations. And of course, this kind of becomes a perpetual problem, because if your boss thinks that there's something wrong with your work, they pull you into a meeting, you're like, what the hell's going on? Why did you miss these words? And you don't know why. You can't point to anything. You just end up feeling like an idiot. And then you think that everyone else thinks you're an idiot. And then then you make another mistake because you're stressed out, and that stress is making you ping more, or it's making your, you know, you forget a bit more forgetful. And all of those sort of, you know, things that aren't great for work, they kind of kick up an extra notch. And then that causes social problems at home. I think I was going through a breakup with my ex-fiance, obviously now, at the time that I'm thinking of when I was doing my first job in a paper. And that was, you know, very difficult, because the two things were constantly overlapping in terms of stress. And in the end, I burned out very, you know, after about sort of 6-7 months. But and that was difficult, because the only thing that ends up at the end of it is you feel like there's something bad with you. And there is, but it's not anything that you think it is if you don't know it's ADHD, because you go to the doctor and they say, they test you for things like depression and anxiety. They don't test you for ADHD, because it's still kind of, there's not that much kind of known about it. And also because it's an underlying issue, and the symptoms of ADHD, when they do flare, are things right. like, they're very common things like anxiety and depression.
Yeah, to go together. Yeah, so are you working in a corporate job, or have you found work that's, I mean, clearly podcasting with Marlon, that's very creative and free-flowing and probably very fun for you. And do you do, and then you're doing the freelance writing, obviously, in like Attitude Magazine. And do you, have you found work that works for how you and your brain works?
Yeah, and well, obviously, in the last year, I've had a very stressful time. So I've taken a step back from sort of, I'd say, mainstream work, and just kind of made sure that I can stabilize across the board, having bought a new flat and everything. So everything's kind of predictable now.
But oh, you're more responsible now with the house?
Yeah.
With the flat?
no, it's just me on my own in here. So yeah, it's nice to have the control over my own environment. It's an incredibly messy one, but it's my mess and I know where everything is, kind of thing.
That's
Marlon
great.
Was around on Monday, actually, as it happens. And I was running around tidying while he was here, just because I was like, oh, goodness me. You know, like,
hey, at least you were tidy.
But I think that in terms of how I've learned that I do work, I think the corporate structures where there's a room for a lot of artificiality in the way that people communicate has always found me feeling like terrible afterwards. And I will probably find that most of those jobs don't last very long, sadly. But the frustration is I'll put everything I've got into it, and I think that it's a meritocracy. And actually, I'll make one or two social faux pas, as only someone with ADHD can, which I'll immediately apologize for and take back. But then, you know, you've screwed it up, and then people start doubting you. And when that kind of goes around, it becomes a groupthink, and then you can't explain yourself. And then you end up in this situation where people don't trust you, or they'll read something about ADHD when you have to explain it, which is something you should never have to do. You don't go up to people with cancer and say, oi, tell us about your chemo.
Right. I agree.
But, you know, you kind of have to, you find yourself explaining why you're weird or why you made these mistakes and why you can't control it. And as a manager, they don't know what to do either, because why would they? So you find yourself in a very awkward position where you're both, where you're simultaneously good at your job, but people don't trust you to do it all the time as predictably as possible, because that's the nature of the game. And subsequently, what I do now is I work about 3 or 4 sort of smaller jobs that have a combined income, so that firstly, the contracts that I do are reasonably valuable. I'm never going to be a millionaire, but it gives me that variety that my brain needs to be interested in. At the same time, because it's the whole thing that I write, that's all quite personal, it's quite interest driven there, helps me explore how my brain works as well as teach others. Then I've got swim teaching, which is just good fun because the kids are adorable.
But, oh, fantastic.
Most of my one-on-ones are ASD. They've all got a little something going on. And it's kind of nice because I'm naturally quite good at, because I see a little bit of me in that when they're just like, but they're absolutely not following it. And you're like, oh, I love you. But also we have like, screw it. You know, I get paid the same for every half hour anyway. And they are good fun to teach.
They probably adore you, and they're probably thankful for you.
I hope so. It's very rewarding. And I think that that's just as important as money. But yep. I say that as somebody who's.
No, those are wise words. Yeah. Wise words.
Yeah. I mean, I found that they're, it's okay to kind of hop around a bit as long as you've got a theme. And I think that it's more important to have a theme in what you're doing rather than specific jobs. And I think that that kind of applies across my career, because I've been a teacher and I've been a journalist. I'm currently a copywriter, which is kind of good. Do this kind of stuff occasionally. What else? And, you know, like, and I think having those two avenues really has been quite beneficial.
Yeah.
And at the moment, you know, and also it gives me the ability to just, if I want to do something completely different, like run off to India on a trip, which is kind of on the plan a bit, I can just do that. And once one of the contracts ends, and take a break from all of it, because I'm only temporary and they don't need me.
Yeah.
And also, you're if not, I get fired from one, then that's not a big deal.
Right. That sounds like a great plan.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
It seems to be working okay for you.
Now. It is for now, but I think that if, you know, I mean, don't, you know, if it all went tits up at once, which things tend to, then I'd be a little bit, I'd be very much in the same position as I would if I put all my eggs in one basket. And time management does play into it. So for example, this is my to-do list for today alone.
It's very long.
Yeah, it's 3 pages long. But but it's going all right. I mean, there are only little things like, you know, make a phone call and do this, do that. And I think list making is very important to.
Yeah. Well, you should be very proud of yourself at the end of the day if you complete that 3-page to-do list.
Oh, yeah.
I can't do that.
Well, I mean, the little things like, you know, like cool restaurant and things like that. You know, those jobs I absolutely hate.
Yeah.
I know they're going to take 5 minutes, but then you've got things like, you know, the jobs that are going to take 3 hours. And I mean, they are so far in the back of my, they're on page 3, let's put it that way, and they have been for days.
That sounds actually typical, if you will. So let me ask you, I don't know if this is a myth or if it's true, but do you find your ADHD symptoms have improved as you mature as a person? Like, for example, you wrote a to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
3 pages, which is really impressive for anybody, and that you do kind of try to check the list off. Were you able to do that when you were in junior high?
I wouldn't say so much when I was little, because things are dictated to you more.
Okay.
I think though that when it comes to sort of the concept of being mature, it's a mixed bag, because you do obviously mature as you get older, but people's expectations also change as well. So you have to first understand what those expectations are. So, you know, which is something, and also because time is, my version of time, so to speak, is the past is within 3 weeks, or at least that's why I talk about it. Now is now, and then the future is 3 weeks in 3 weeks. So it gets progressively smushed up as we go through time. Now, also—
Okay, so explain that to me. How does it get, so when you think of the future, you only look as far as 3 weeks?
Sort of. I mean, I think that I'm reluctant to plan major events because of the unpredictability.
Okay, got it. Beyond 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So tell me, okay, Marlon is your best friend. You guys are doing this podcast together. Right. Marlon, what do you love about Les?
It's interesting because I met Les in 2010, and when I first initially met him, I didn't like him at all.
Where did you meet him?
In university. So okay. We lived together in halls or student accommodation. We lived together in my first year and his third year.
Okay.
In university. And I remember the first time I actually met him, and I tell this story on our podcast. I had somebody partying on his side of the accommodation. So I went over to see what was going on. If there's a party going on, I wouldn't mind getting involved. So I walked over there. I started talking to somebody who I know. And then this guy just burst out of a room somewhere. And he just looks at me, makes eye contact with me, and just looks at me and goes, "Who is this big black guy?"
Runs over. He is 6'6", to be fair. And I'm only 5'11".
Wait, how tall is Marlon?
I'm 6'6".
Oh my gosh, okay.
It was a valid point, but yeah, he rushes over to me, he's right in my face, like, "Nice to meet you." I was just like leaning away, get away from me. Who is this person?
To be fair, yeah. I mean, like, we had been partying quite hard for about 3 weeks at that point.
Yeah, so it was love at first sight, kind of.
No, it wasn't. Well, I didn't like him. I didn't like him for the first 2 months. I just couldn't understand him.
You lying bastard! You say it was more than that. You said it was less than that.
About 2 months.
Too much. But it wasn't after he hugged you that you came around?
No.
That was probably a problem. I didn't like introvert.
Yeah. I didn't like him at all. But what it was is I had a one, like, when I first met him, it was like a social situation in front of everybody. I think Les speaks about the whole peacocking thing, what he does.
Yeah.
As somebody that have ADHD, you could probably explain that whole scenario better than I can.
But, you come bigger than life?
Yes.
Not quite. It's more that you get anxious because everybody around you, you're trying to connect with everyone at once, but you've not got the capacity to do that. So you end up telling stories that are a bit larger than life in a way, but also because if everyone's laughing, it's safe. And whereas if they kind of look to the side at each other and things like that, then that makes you more nervous, so you double down. And it's something I only really learned I was doing about 2 years ago. But it makes, in a group setting, it means that you kind of come across as a bit of a narcissist because you'll go in there, big show, and then as if you're talking to an audience, and then you retreat, which is an ADHD thing. But I didn't know that. I didn't know I was doing that. So I then kind of become socially exhausted and withdrawn. And what it looks like to someone else is that I'm done talking about me. I don't care about you. When actually I do care about them, but it feels like it's time to go away now. So I'm trying to engage with everybody at once, and then I will remove myself. But if you talk to me one-on-one, then I can focus just on the person, and I'm really interested and I really care about people. I mean, that's the irony of it all, is that I do really give a shit, you know, more than anything.
Yeah. And do you call that peacocking when you go into a party or a large crowd?
It's a behavior within that kind of context. Like a peacock, nowadays, yeah. It's okay. A lot less so, but it's, yeah, because you end up kind of going around being like, ta-da.
Yeah, put up your feathers. And
yeah, and then you walk away and then no one knows where the hell, why you've spent 20 minutes sitting on the toilet, and that's just to recharge your...
Oh, yeah. Do you still do that today? That's a thing, right? Like,
I did it actually at a party the other day. I found myself telling too many stories and I kind of got bored of myself. So but I was lucky because it was my sister-in-law's party, and I was meeting all these very intelligent people from Cambridge, and I just got socially tired. So I retreated to a safe corner with my brother and his friends who all know me. One of them has actually been on our podcast. And so, you know, like, it was a safer zone, and I could just sit there on my phone, be like, for about 5 minutes, and then get up and just, and also I make an active effort now to ask people questions and do things like active listening. I actually took a counseling course recently, so that to improve my listening skills, so it does come across like a bit better, and also because I am interested in people fundamentally. But you never really know when to shut up, and I think that links back to the maturity thing, where it's okay to shut up, and that silences aren't my responsibility. Whereas it always used to feel like if people didn't know what to say back, or if there wasn't something that they were saying, then I had to fill that silence, which of course isn't the case. It can just be a silence.
Right. Yeah. Well, Les, you sound very wise. You've learned quite a bit. You'd probably be a really good therapist.
Well, hopefully, but I think I'm talking about myself instead.
People learn through stories, right? It's a great way to learn. That's how I've learned all kinds of things in my life, right? From listening to other people tell their shared experience. So yeah. I appreciate it. Okay. So Marlon. Back to Marlon.
So I later understood that whole peacocking thing when Lev explained it to me years later. But when I first met him, he sort of rubbed me the wrong way, and I thought he was a bit of an arsehole.
It's only
I remember he was skipping. I think he was trying to lose weight during the first semester in university, and I bumped into you, and I was only planning to have a quick conversation with you. I spoke to you for about 5 minutes, and that conversation turned into 4 hours, and I ended up spending the day with you. And that's when me and you became actual friends from that day on. Just, I actually got to know you one-on-one, and it sort of makes me think about people who I grew up with that have ADHD that I didn't give the time to. But I guess because me and you lived together, I had to make the effort to try to give you the time of day. But once getting over some of your symptoms of ADHD and getting used to your quirks, getting used to you as a person, you became one of my favorite person. You're just hilarious.
Yeah, I love that.
Also, Marlon following me. Marlon, when we used to get drunk together, Marlon kind of become, he's an introvert, I'm an extrovert. So we would go around the student union together because he literally stands head and shoulders above everyone. So he's kind of like this, it's like a battle flag in medieval times.
A beacon.
And so I used to just kind of, and like, so he, but then there'd be times when he was kind of like tired, or he just wasn't feeling, or he was just smashed out of his brains. So he would just follow me because I was the one who'd, because we would be doing rounds where it's like, I buy one, he buys one, you know, like that kind of thing, and share it. And he ended up basically just being my bodyguard because I will run my mouth accidentally in the wrong place. And then you'll end up with some
big friend. He'd kind of save you.
And then Marlon will just lean over. It's like, is there a problem? And suddenly this arsehole didn't have a problem.
The funny thing about that story, I didn't realize that was what was happening. I was just like with the groups. I didn't realize you were getting into issues and then they were backing down because they see me. I didn't realize that at the time until you told me.
Yeah, because like, who the hell is this with you? You've got arms like his arms are so big, they're bigger than my legs.
It's just do a flex, Marlon.
Yeah, go on, Marlon.
I'm not gonna do it.
Do it.
The cool kids are doing it.
Well, I love that story. And I love that you love Les and Les loves you. And
I mean, it's kind of starting to sound a little bit.
I know, but you know what? Having friendship is good, and it's important in life, and it's what gets us through. So I love that story. Okay, so Les, anything else that you want, any words of wisdom beyond what you've shared with us?
Got a lot of pages set here, but no, I think I've kind of covered a few
bits. There anything that you, because I had sent Les some questions and we haven't gotten to all of them, but is there anything that you like thought about that that you wanted to share with people?
I mean, I did write an awful lot about parenting because I appreciate that, you know, you're an ADHD parent. Yeah.
Okay, so tell me, like, what would you tell a parent if that has an ADHD child? Like, what should they, how can they support them the best way?
I think that the best way to do it is there's two sides of it. There's the emotional care and letting them know that you have to kind of give them boundaries, but you have to explain those boundaries. So if someone ever says no because I said so, I'm gonna question it, and I'm gonna question it until it makes them angrier. And the next thing I know is that I'm gonna be in trouble for asking why I'm in trouble. This is something that ADHD kids get a lot of because they will test you in terms of the validity of what you're saying. And so as a consequence, if you don't have the patience or you don't have a reason to do that, then that will make you question yourself. And then it becomes about your ego rather than about the conversation. Personally, even as a child, I always thought that it was weird when adults would talk down to me because why? So as an adult, I don't really tend to talk down to children that much, unless of course they're two and they're just really cute. But that's one of the things, is that an ADHD person will always want to know the exact amount of information, because that's where how they are going to judge those boundaries, through that kind of, we don't touch the stove because it's hot, and then they're still going to touch the stove and they're going to learn that you were right. But you know, you have to kind of be patient and let them make mistakes. But also, when they do make those mistakes and they do get hurt, you have to assure them that it's not entirely their fault, because you have a lot of, as some of the issues, you get a lot of underlying guilt, and there was another part of it as well, guilt and shame. Those are two things that we experience a lot of, but we don't know how to express it. So as a consequence, it comes out a bit sort of odd. And you can't just wait out something like an ADHD tantrum. I know that you've got a teenage son. And so when you have all of that stress that compiles, we need to know how to get rid of it in a healthy way. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a volcano and you're going to, and that's very problematic. A lot of the issues that ADHD people face actually isn't ADHD, it's how their behavior is perceived. And that's where most of my troubles have actually come from. It's not been me actively pursuing a line of, you know, doing something that's stupid or bad. But I've ended up in some serious trouble for just being, and it feels like just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's not to absolve myself from any responsibility. But for example, if I was to, but you know, I mean, like, but the punishment doesn't fit the crime because people jump to extremes based on their own schemas that isn't the case.
Right.
And it's very difficult to explain the concept of impulsivity to somebody who isn't impulsive, in the same way that it's difficult for me to understand somebody who meticulously plans a holiday to the detail, instead of just going out there and enjoying themselves and kind of going with the flow, because it just doesn't, it's not the way that my head works in the same way it works.
That's a great analogy.
So, yeah. And also it's, when it comes to, because we think in extremes, you have to give us a scale of 1 to 10 as to where we are in that, in how much trouble we're in or what, how upset people are.
Oh, that's a great tip.
Yeah.
So the scale of like getting angry or the scale of getting in trouble, like the severity of where this trouble is.
Yeah. Or like how big the problem is. Because to me, I mean, I know that I come from back. There's a lot of anxiety sometimes, and especially with growing anxiety of a parent, because you see your son or your daughter go through these troubles. And as a parent, I know that, you know, you never want anything bad to happen to them, but they will, because society and, you know, the world is hard. And if someone's not, doesn't seem to understand the rules of that society, or doesn't really seem to understand that, then they get in disproportionate amounts of trouble because people think that they're acting that way on intentionally, and therefore they are devious. But actually, there has never been a devious time for anyone that I know with ADHD who's found themselves in trouble, including myself, actually. And so that's why.
So how do you, as a parent, how would you help? So go back to the boundaries. How do you, as a parent, trying to explain to an ADHD child the boundaries? Like what, how does it?
You have to explain it to them in a way that doesn't blame them, and they can't blame themselves. So you can explain the other person's actions and reactions to what they're doing, and you'll hear them say stuff like, yeah, but I didn't mean it. That's a catchphrase. And then you have to teach them how to mitigate the other person's reaction in a way that is most effective. But also sometimes you have to be able to tell them, look, don't worry about it. The other guy's just a dick.
Right.
And that's okay too, because otherwise they're going to blame themselves the whole time. And you have to make it very clear in a way that you wouldn't for a normal person that they didn't do anything wrong and that it's not their fault. But sometimes it is. I mean, obviously, you know, there's no smoke without fire. You can't harness that energy either. You can't make them do what you want them to do in the same way they can't just do what you say.
Right.
So you have to kind of have that flexibility, and it's all about kind of, it's like the theme thing from earlier. You know, you have to give them a theme of what's going on and let them figure it out their own way. But if you give them that box to bounce around instead of telling them to go down that line, then that's a lot. That makes life a lot easier for them, because it shows that they can be creative, but within a certain range, in the same way that they might be in trouble, but they're only a 4 out of 10 trouble, whereas they will instantly think they're 10 out of 10 trouble. And they'll react to that way. And then their anxiety will base that. Sorry, I'm dancing a bit there. But when the ADHD person gets excited or anxious, and this is one of the reasons I lost my last job, actually, is because my boss, because I was under a lot of pressure to learn so much and then do so much in a very short amount of time, when I already had a backlog of stress that was this, well, it gave me heart palpitations in the end. That extra pressure and every little bit of pressure just builds on this huge mountain that no one can see.
Yeah.
So we instantly relate it to, and it's a very quick process, to a dozen other things. So for example, if you're like, oh, that work wasn't great, not your best work there, you'll be like, you know, a normal person will be like, oh, well, I just had a bad day, sorry about that, mate, and then no one cares. ADHD person will go home and dwell on it until 4 a.m, come back tomorrow morning, still feeling like they should really apologize for it. And then so you end up, you know, in this cycle where you look suspicious for the way you've reacted rather as an ADHD person, and that leads to more suspicion. And the next thing you know is that it snowballs in a way that makes no logical sense.
Right.
But a lot of that is our reaction. So you have to kind of temper their reaction in a way that, or guide that reaction in terms of the reality of the situation as objectively as possible, and then just kind of support them rather than tell them off or tell them what to do. So they're not going to obey, or, well, they will obey orders. We have a very strong sense of authority, ironically, as well. But that respect for authority comes from is a mutual one, as it always should be. So, for example, Marlon's the producer and the writer in our little get-up, and if Marlon tells me, no, I'm going to edit that out, he's got the respect for me to say, actually, no, I want to keep that in, or can you cut out that bit where I sounded like an idiot? And he'll do that for me. And then, but I'll also write an entire episode in a couple of hours or whatever. And, you know, just to make, and I'm the one who comes up with the theme within our podcast. So, you know, you have your own role to play, but they're respected equally. And the same thing applies to parenting. The parent is the guide, not, you know, they're not, they don't have to be the full authority, but they will naturally become the teaching authority in the same way that a good teacher is. And as a teacher, I've seen that with kids who are written off by other teachers who are perhaps more strict or perhaps more closed-minded, and they didn't react to them properly. But I understand, you have to kind of go underneath the hood. And I understood that, for example, this guy who was acting up, I actually took the time to listen to him and said, look, well, what's going on? Whereas the other teacher was like, he's acting up, we should punish him. Or, you know, like, yes. and that went worse. And it just made the whole thing worse because he was acting up more just to piss her off. Yeah. Because he felt more restricted by her in a way that wasn't okay. But also, there's no reason why someone with ADHD can't compete on the same playing field as anyone else. And it shouldn't be seen as a sort of, as a hindrance to success. And I think that that's one of the reasons I'm actually quite grateful that I was diagnosed later, because if I'd known that, I would have been treated differently growing up by, say, you know, sympathetic teachers and subconscious bias. You know, oh, it's Les, he's acting up, therefore we can let him get away with that, when actually I couldn't and I shouldn't. Or, you know, like, I appreciate that's a bit hypocritical, but you know what I mean? There's a difference between letting him get away with it. But, you know, but the people who I worked for the best were the ones who were loyal for me, you know, who were nice to me, who were just simply kind, and who were good to me and who were loyal to me. And I returned that in droves, to the extent that even though I was the most annoying kid in my psychology classes, when I went to hospital for 5 days, the lesson that was 2 hours long, my teacher would give about 15 minutes in his lesson plan for Les rambling time. Because I put my hand up and I'd go,
oh, you loved that, yeah.
And it would just be entertaining and everyone would just be sitting there like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, I don't know, and I don't know how to stop. I'm trying to dig my way out of everything I said. And then I was gone. And then all of a sudden it was very quiet. And about halfway through that class, it just goes, I miss Les. And everyone goes, yeah, me too. And then they spent the rest of the class making me a card, and I've still got it.
I love that. Yeah. Lots of wisdom, Les. I really appreciate it. And a lot of timely advice as well. Okay, guys. So I thank you for your time.
Not at all. Thank you for having us. It's really great.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers.